Good evening and welcome to this ordinary general meeting of the Institute of Actuaries. Copies of the minutes of the ordinary general meeting held on the 26th of January have been displayed on the Institute notice board and will be taken as read. May I sign the minutes as a correct record? Yes, Jeremy. Thank you. Hugo. Sorry, Benedict, I beg your pardon. This is Benedict McHugo, he's not Hugo McBenedict. Very good. I'd like to welcome the guests, and in particular, I'd like to welcome Paul Sharma. He's going to be a bit late, but he will be here. Sarah Varney, Manager Insurance Technical Research Team of the FSA. Benedict McHugo, it says here, Head of Prudential Reporting at the ABI. Peter Vipond, Head of Financial Regulation and Taxation at the ABI. Helen Martin, Past President of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia. And Kathy Lynn, who's putting a coat downstairs and also doing the lonely walk shortly to come up the front. She's from PwC in Toronto.
She's here.
She's where? She's there. Well, welcome. Missed you. Right. I'm now delighted to welcome Sayanthan Pathmanathan of Norwich Union. He's the winner of the Watson Wyatt Prize for Financial Economics, awarded to the best performing student in subject 109, the Financial Economics paper for the September 2003 examination diet. The award of this prize has been made possible by Watson Wyatt LLP, offering to provide sponsorship to the profession. In addition to providing the prize, Watson's will also sponsor other educational work undertaken by the profession, and I'm a great believer in sponsors having their say, so Nick's going to have his say. Where's Nick? There he is.
Thank you very much, President. Watson Wyatt is delighted to have the opportunity to sponsor the prize for the financial economics exam. I don't think you want a commercial from the sponsor this evening, but I would like to say a few words, mainly with my education and CPD board hat on. When Subject 109 was introduced 5 years ago, relatively few actuaries were using the techniques covered in their day-to-day work. But over the past 2 years, the position has changed dramatically, particularly for life actuaries. And it's just as well that we have at least some actuaries who have a good technical grounding in the subject. There's still an awful lot of work to be done to improve our understanding of how to apply financial economic techniques to actuarial work. And clearly the paper this evening is an important contribution to that. As in other areas of actuarial work, the issues are rarely completely black and white, and it's good that the debate in this area is becoming much more constructive. For those who haven't taken an exam in financial economics and are feeling deprived, I have good news for you. The certificate in practical financial economics is very nearly ready to launch, and you can expect to receive strong encouragement from the Institute President, for one, to take it when it's available. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
Yes, I would like to reiterate that. In fact, I was writing that down as Nick was speaking. But, and I would put it this way around: with anybody who hasn't done 103 or 109, should ask themselves why they should not take this course out. I shall be taking the course out myself. I shall be not taking the exam. But I shall take it. Now I'd like to award Sayanthan with his certificate and prize.
We just need to check on the side for that. Very good in the photograph. Congratulations. Well done.
I'd now like to welcome the late arrival of the board, Peter Clark, of the International Accounting Standards Board. You're very welcome. Now to the paper. Paper by Tim Sheldon and Andrew Smith, Market Consistent Valuation of Life Insurance Business. And I'd like to ask Tim Sheldon to introduce the paper.
Mr. President, guests, ladies and gentlemen, this paper was conceived almost a year ago, though events over the past year, in particular the publication of CP195 by the FSA and the continuing challenge presented to the larger with-profit officers in preparing realistic balance sheets, have prompted us to write a rather more wide-ranging paper than we originally intended. While the move to a realistic or market-consistent approach to the valuation of life assurance business for regulatory reporting has in general been welcomed, and there has been much discussion on the detail of CP195, there has been relatively little debate on the reasons for adopting a market-consistent valuation, what the term market-consistent actually means, and on the scope for discretion in the choice of both method and assumptions. Our paper explores some of these issues. Market-consistent valuation has its origins in mark-to-market accounting, applied for many years to organisations whose primary activity is two-way trading in liquid markets. In these conditions, market prices are well-defined and easily observed, making the accounting process straightforward. The long-term liabilities of life officers are not traded in an active market, and consequently a market-consistent valuation relies on model-based valuation techniques to extrapolate from those prices which can be observed. The wide scope for management discretion in with-profits business makes this comparison even more tenuous. This fundamental difference between using market prices and using a model of market price formation results in the need either to rely on judgment or for clear standards and guidance. As we point out in the very first paragraph of the paper, there is no clear definition of market-consistent valuation. A precise specification of the term may depend on the purpose of the valuation. Even in what might appear to be the simplest choice of a risk-free rate of interest, there are several different practices. In a recent survey on realistic balance sheets carried out by our firm, half the respondents were using a gilt-based risk-free curve, while the other half were using swap-based models, mostly without any yield reduction for credit risk. When we turn to assumptions for volatilities and correlations, we encounter more difficult problems, from the absence of a liquid market, or indeed any market for some of the assets held in with-profit funds. Taxation, as always, complicates the choice of assumptions. Several companies are now using Monte Carlo simulations to calculate their realistic liabilities, permitting allowance for management action and policyholder behaviour. These models, while complex, are useful tools, not just for valuation, but more importantly in testing strategies for the management of with-profit funds. There is, though, a popular misconception that the use of the Black-Scholes option pricing formula and its relatives is appropriate only for the simplest guarantees. This is not the case. While it may not be possible to calibrate a suitable option pricing formula for every type of management action, it may be possible to achieve a satisfactory fit using an exotic option formula. Such an approach may prove invaluable when projecting realistic balance sheets or in sensitivity testing. We have highlighted some of the difficulties in applying market-consistent valuation to life assurance business, and many of these difficulties will also be encountered in the valuation of other liabilities. We also offer what we hope are some practical ways forward through these difficulties. Some may regard the approach as too difficult for what will still be an imperfect method of valuation. The central question, though, is whether market-consistent valuation will enable better management of those financial institutions whom we advise. In our view, it will, and market-consistent valuation, while not perfect, is a marked improvement on what we had before.
Thank you, President. I'd like to thank the authors for a very interesting paper. It's obviously also particularly timely given the current debate on how to implement the proposed new rules on realistic valuation of life insurance business. The paper covers a lot of ground. The main focus is on deriving assumptions and formulae for market-consistent valuation of life assurance business, either from a policyholder or a shareholder perspective. But it also discusses hedging of risks within the business. One thing the paper certainly does is dispel any lingering thoughts that market-consistent valuation might be straightforward. The authors helpfully highlight a number of traps for the unwary. For example, 4.5.18 points out the possible importance of negative interest rate scenarios using the Hull-White model. The paper also explains some subtle effects of taxation. The authors present a coherent and logical framework for market-consistent valuation, together with a well-argued rationale. However, I believe there are occasions where theoretical niceties have won out over the practicalities of the real world. We should not forget that the major life insurers must implement the FSA's new rules in the very near future. The resources of the industry are finite, and I suspect that some of the author's refinements will have to stay in the too difficult box for some considerable time. Nor should we overstate the extent to which other financial companies already adhere to the principles discussed in this paper. 2.4.7.5 suggests the authors believe the banks use mark-to-market accounting. This is emphatically not the case with their loan books, especially problem credits. Insurers, by contrast, do mark their loans, bonds or private debt, to market, and so need to represent the long-term nature of their business on the liability side of the balance sheet. The paper discusses several important questions which deserve comment. Should guaranteed liabilities be discounted using gilt yields or swap rates? What is the appropriate balance between accuracy of calibration fit and likely applicability to the liabilities valued? Should options be valued using implied or historic volatilities, or indeed expected realised volatilities? And how can Monte Carlo simulation and formula-based valuation best be combined? The authors start by discussing possible reasons for market-consistent valuation. This is a fundamental issue which will affect the answers to some of the questions raised. The FSA's stated intention to make the regulation of insurers more like that of banks suggests that the author's third reason, the desire for comparable valuations which reduce the need for subjective judgment, is paramount. The authors also rightly point in 2.3.3 to the impact that unhedged guarantees have had on the industry in recent years. Hence, a desire for a more holistic approach to risk management is clearly also a driver behind the introduction of a realistic balance sheet. But does this mean that insurance companies should be expected to survive a period of market dislocation which leads to insolvencies amongst the banking sector, as seems to be implied by the author's advocacy of the case for gilt yields rather than swap rates? In 2.3.6, the paper makes the argument that market-consistent valuation should contribute to ensuring financial soundness. I imagine no one would argue with that. Requiring insurers to hold sufficient assets to meet a theoretical buyout test in normal times, as well as risk-based capital to cover the likelihood of significant increases in costs during conditions of financial distress, seems entirely sensible. Of course, this must generally be a theoretical test because there may well be no realistic opportunity for an actual buyout. But it is by no means clear that the capital should be required to meet buyout costs in distressed situations where any buyout market might be suffering extreme dislocation. The effect of requiring super solvency from insurers can be seen clearly in 3.4.3, where the authors acknowledge that consistency in the use of gilt yields would require LIBOR-linked deposits accepted by an insurer to be valued above face value. Whatever happened to the idea of a level playing field with banks? Again, in 3.4.2, the authors clearly suggest that where an insurer is liable to pay cash flows under an over-the-counter derivative contract, such as a swap, then the market-consistent value of the liability is different from that which would apply if it was liable to pay the same cash flows under an insurance policy. This might be the intention of a regulator seeking solely to guarantee the solvency of insurance companies, but again does not suggest a level playing field. I believe that the solution to these anomalies as well as to the issues raised in 4.3 concerning the fact that market values of options depend on swap rates rather than gilt rates, is to accept that swap rates should be the starting point in deriving the realistic balance sheet. The authors summarise their view in 3.3.9 that insurance solvency supervision is most usefully implemented relative to a liability that is as close to risk-free as possible. I would summarise my own view in contrast as being that it should be relative to a liability that is as close to market consistent as possible. This is not to deny that most financial transactions tend to involve an element of credit risk. However, I believe the appropriate place to allow for the credit risk inherent in derivative transactions is in the risk capital margin, as would also be the case, for example, with credit risk associated with reinsurance arrangements. On the general question of model calibration, the paper points out that difficult decisions must be made. No model, however complex, will be able to replicate the prices of all financial instruments accurately, although it may be possible to cover a wider spread through varying the parameters in a formula-based approach than through Monte Carlo simulation. Hence, it is important to consider the nature of the liabilities that the model will be used to value, and choose a model and calibration which is expected to produce appropriate values for these particular liabilities. The question of the choice of volatility assumption is highlighted by the author's example of property assets in 7.3.5. As the paper says, options on property are not generally available, and if they were, then implied volatilities would almost certainly be much higher than realised historic volatilities or expected future volatilities. Does this mean that we should be inventing a high implied volatility to use? And what purpose would be served by doing so? Similarly, the author's point in 4.6 point out that there is no market in the correlation between equities and fixed interest. In fact, it is possible to get quotes on options on a combination of these assets, meaning that it is possible to derive an implied correlation. But in no way can this be called an efficient market. So what are we to do in practice? I agree with the authors that it is not appropriate simply to use implied volatilities where hedging assets have been purchased and historic volatilities otherwise, as this violates the principle that the value of the liabilities should be independent of the assets held, unless, of course, the liabilities actually depend on the performance of the assets. Although not justifiable theoretically, the pragmatic solution would seem to be to use market-implied parameters where a reasonably efficient market is thought to exist, for example, short-term equity volatility, medium-term interest rate volatility, but to use forecast parameters, probably based on historical data, where no such market exists, for example, long-dated equity volatility, property volatility correlations. The paper includes a lot of useful ideas and formulae for valuing particular types of liabilities. For example, I thought the concept of a super risky asset in 5.4 was an ingenious approach to seeking to capture the effect of a dynamic investment policy. There are also a lot of helpful references to work in other fields addressing the valuation of complex options, and a good discussion in Section 8 of the pros and cons of Monte Carlo simulation and closed form solutions. As the paper points out, one of the key benefits of deriving valuation formulae is to obtain an insight into the dependence of the liability valuation on important parameter assumptions. This can be useful even where it is recognised that the formulae are not sufficiently general to provide the basis of the valuation itself. The paper also highlights what some of those key parameters are likely to be, namely long-dated volatilities and correlations, and assumptions about future management and policyholder actions. The authors seem to play down the impact of management flexibility, suggesting in 8.2.4 that such flexibility is likely to be less important today following recent market conditions. Clearly, this will depend on the circumstances of individual offices, especially on the level of guarantees granted, including past bonuses. The final section of the paper touches on the important topic of hedging risks in with-profits funds. The authors identify the problems that the common practice of allocating the same investment return to all asset shares introduces. They also discuss possible ways to charge for guarantees and some alternative methods of hedging. Perhaps the most important conclusion of the paper is that reasons exist for legitimate differences of opinion over important assumptions, suggesting that the original aim of comparable valuations may be frustrated. However, we should not forget that, although there is room for significant variation in the final outcome, the whole concept of the realistic balance sheet is undoubtedly a huge step forward. It is better to be roughly right than exactly wrong, and tonight's paper should certainly help us to be so.
open to the floor. I have been given the names of 13 people who would like to speak, so the three-minute rule will apply tonight. But could I have a show of hands, including the 13, so I can get a view, a show of hands of those who'd like to say something tonight, please. Could you put your hands up? Okay. Right. Thank you. And for the aficionados of the news quiz, you'll recognise my timekeeper, Samantha, here, who will keep you in check. And there's a little red light will appear on the dais, and if you ignore that for more than a nanosecond, then I shall shout at you. Please don't let the fact the meeting is being recorded deter you from contributing. All speakers will be given the opportunity to see their comments before they're published in the BAJ. If 3 minutes doesn't allow you to make your full comments, they may be submitted after the meeting as a written contribution. Roving microphones are available if anyone in the gallery or the back wants to speak, but otherwise come up to the front. And could I ask you to please state your name clearly before speaking? I shall first take the 13 who have rung in to say they'd like to speak. And so that you have an approximate idea as where you are, I shall take you in alphabetical order of surname. So could we have Tamsin Abbey first, please? Bad luck, Tamsin.
Tamsin Abbey. Market-consistent actuarial valuations are being used more and more in actual M&A transactions, particularly in the case of the sale of closed-with-profit fund portfolios. While understanding the long-term nature of life insurance business, the purchaser's primary interest is in capital availability and its releasability. Traditional embedded values do not allow explicitly for the cost of options and guarantees embedded in a with-profits portfolio. The valuation also normally assumes that shareholders' transfers from life insurance business are immediately available to shareholders, i.e. they discount at a rate above the net risk-free rate, the risk discount rate, earned from the date of the bonus declaration or profit distribution. Allowance is sometimes made for the cost of holding back the solvency margin until that amount is releasable to shareholders. Some companies have been producing realistic or modified embedded values which have taken the first step towards trying to use a more market-consistent approach and do contain an explicit valuation of the cost of market risks, such as guarantees and options. However, a market-consistent valuation for M&A transaction purposes tends to differ to the latter for two main reasons. Firstly, the shareholder transfers in a realistic EV methodology tend to be the same as for a traditional EV and do not allow for the restrictions that a regulator might apply to releases as capital. For example, a fund being in deficit, another part of the group being in deficit, or failing to meet an assumed RCM/ICA required level going forward. A truer reflection of the value of a company is based on the flows of capital at the point to which they become available to the shareholders. The second is an allowance for all the risks that the company is subject to. The realistic EV places a value on the shareholder transfers, allowing for market risk, and then discounts the resulting flows at a risk-free rate. This does not take into account the full range of non-market risks that a company may be subject to, ranging from the often excluded more actuarial type risks such as mortality and persistency, through to operational risks such as regulatory change, brand reputation, and systems and controls. As it is extremely unlikely that it will be possible to model all these non-financial risks explicitly, a higher discount rate than risk-free can be the best proxy. A market-consistent valuation of a life company for M&A transaction purposes would tend to be on a capital is king-style approach, involving the discounting of capital from the date dividendable to shareholders at a rate higher than risk-free rate. The actual rate would depend on the required capital returns of the purchaser and their views of the premium to be paid for taking on the non-explicit risks. This requires the calculation of the projected realistic balance sheets for with-profit funds, projection of balance sheets for unit-linked to non-profit funds, plus the RCM/ICA capital requirements of the regulators. excess capital above that to be required can be dividended over a period and valued at the required rate. We would not be surprised if the realistic balance sheet became a precondition of the sale of a close-with-profit fund. This demonstrates the value of the techniques in the paper for commercial transactions and internal management purposes, as well as to enable companies to meet the regulatory requirements.
Anthony Bice.
I'd like to add my thanks to the authors for a well-written contribution to this very important field of practice. It's encouraging that the profession is ready to discuss the kind of detailed points of market-consistent valuation presented here. I'd like to cover two areas. Firstly, on calculation techniques, the authors outline the benefits and drawbacks of closed-form solutions versus simulations in Section 8, and also touch on this topic in Section 5. It would seem that the choice is between getting a good fit to market prices via closed-form solutions, where the input parameters can be adjusted on a policy-by-policy basis if desired, or allowing a more detailed model of the product structures and available discretion from a simulation model, but with a poorer fit to market prices. In practice, it's likely that both of these approaches will be used for market-consistent valuation, depending on the purpose, and I expect to see further developments in both techniques. The authors present a number of extensions to the basic Black or Black-Scholes model in an attempt to improve the ability of closed-form solutions to fit product structures. Unfortunately, they don't present any quantitative analysis to show how successful these extensions are. There is perhaps a danger in spending too much time over-engineering closed-form solutions to the point that we miss some of the more important issues, such as understanding the dynamics and drivers of value. One of the benefits of simple closed-form solutions is that they are just that, simple. Their benefits and flaws can be easily understood. Additional complexity might add some incremental accuracy, but it will potentially make it much more difficult to understand what is driving the results. There is also the danger of targeting accuracy in one area, but allowing much greater inaccuracy in other areas. Examples might include where liabilities are backed by credit-risky assets, illiquid assets such as mortgages, or derivatives. Closed-form solutions are likely to be far less accurate here compared to simulation, and small gains in reproducing the details of bonus policy are likely to be far outweighed by inaccuracies in these other areas. Obviously, where product structures are simple enough or where simulation is not feasible, analytic solutions will suffice, and the authors make a case for their use when embedding future realistic balance sheets within stochastic scenarios. Of course, this in itself presents other modelling issues, and to work well, we have to ensure that the projection software and models are up to the task. However, if the impact of bonus strategy, dynamic asset mix, or policyholder behaviour is the focus, or if the asset mix involves the use of credit-risky assets or derivatives, I doubt that many will feel that the incremental benefit from more complex closed-form solutions is worth the opacity that this brings. This will be particularly the case for product development and scenario testing of management strategies. Secondly, the paper concentrates on the use of market-consistent values for the point-in-time measurement of insurance liabilities. However, its benefits can be much further reaching than this. In particular, it can be used to give much greater insights to the profit dynamics of both the in-force book and new products than past methods of analysis have done. It is an extremely powerful tool. I hope that the use of market-consistent valuations does not become simply an esoteric tool for the valuation actuary, but is incorporated into the broader management of insurance companies, from product design, risk and capital management, performance management, through to larger strategic decisions such as M&A. Of course, in these areas, there is no reward for the laxity that the authors are so keen to find elsewhere. Instead, the rewards are in understanding that sensible and robust use of market-consistent techniques can bring. A market-consistent management framework has the potential to create a much safer, more stable, more transparent, and at the same time, more profitable insurance industry, which would be to the benefit of both policyholders and shareholders.
Thanks. Mark Chaplin, then Dave Dulloway.
I would like to begin by congratulating the authors on a well-written and informative paper that draws attention to some of the detailed practical difficulties involved in market-consistent modelling and offers a number of innovative solutions. The paper serves to highlight the significant challenges posed to the actuarial profession, the insurance industry and the regulators in achieving the aim of a more transparent, objective and comparable set of financial reporting information. Indeed, some of the uncertainties covered in the paper bring home the very real danger that a headlong rush to disclose market-consistent valuations in advance of a common standard may further undermine the confidence of policyholders, equity analysts, the media and any other participants in or commentators on the life insurance industry. To this end, I believe that the establishment of an actuarial standards board or a comparable mechanism for imposing standards should be expedited. Moving on to three more specific comments on the paper. Firstly, the authors make an observation that the use of dynamic decision rules tends to produce an implied volatility that decreases as policy guarantees move further out of the money. This observation is coupled with a remark that volatility skew operates in the opposite direction and is used to draw the conclusion that a fixed implied volatility and dynamic decision rules effectively double counts the management action. I believe that this conclusion is flawed for two reasons. Firstly, it's possible that fixed implied volatility used may have been derived from an out-of-the-money option. And secondly, volatility skew and management actions represent two very different effects, which could have significantly different sizes. My second point covers the guaranteed annuity option evaluation methodology set out in section 5.7. The authors put forward an argument for using an estimate of an open market option annuity price to value the payoff under a guaranteed annuity option. This is offered as a better alternative to the more common approach of using a market consistent value of the annuity. One might also think of this as suggesting the use of an offer price rather than a mid-market price. While I agree with the logic of using an offer price for determining the policyholder take-up rate for the guaranteed annuity option, I believe that using an annuity rate, including margins, would be inconsistent with the valuation approach unless pricing margins are included in all the assumptions. Finally, and possibly more substantially, the authors suggest that a number of possible approaches and benefits to developing closed form solutions as possible alternative to Monte Carlo simulations. While I do not doubt the benefits of having reliable formulaic alternative to Monte Carlo simulations, and believe that the methodologies outlined may have some useful applications, I would disagree with the author's remark in paragraph 8.2.4 that bonus rates and many funds' equity contents are significantly lower, so the impact of management discretion may be much reduced. The benefits of Monte Carlo modelling may therefore not be so great in current conditions compared with simple formula methods. On the contrary, our recent ALM and realistic balance sheet work, both in the UK and in continental Europe, where equity backing ratios are frequently lower, has shown that management discretion can still have a critical impact on the value attributed to guarantees. I should add that this is in cases or countries where management discretion still exists. As commented in the paper, paragraph 8.2.2, fund-level decision rules pose a significant obstacle to the development of representative closed-form solutions. There is a danger that, in ignoring fund-level decision rules, such as guarantee recharging, closed-form methods can significantly overstate the cost of guarantees. Thank you.
David Dunaway, then Cameron Ferrugi.
David Dunaway. This is an impressive paper and there's much in it I'd like to discuss this evening. Indeed, there's even much I agree with. However, within the limited time available, I shall restrict myself to the issues of calibration, and in particular the choice of the risk-free rate. I'd like just to remind ourselves that why we have a calibration. In theory, a market-consistent valuation is one that values assets and liabilities at their market prices, or, more usually, by reference to an appropriate hedging portfolio. If we put to one side diversifiable risk, this means finding the price of a portfolio of traded assets and derivative securities that exactly match an insurance company's liabilities. The price of constructing this portfolio is the value of the liability. At this most simple level, there is no question of calibration. We simply look up market prices in the paper. In practice, of course, we don't do this, and for two reasons. The first is it would be extremely tedious.
given the number of cash flows we're trying to value. And the second is we don't always have access to all the prices we want to look at. Instead, we pick a model that broadly represents the behaviour of asset prices. We use the market prices to calibrate the model, and then we use that model to value the liabilities. But we must remember that model is just a shortcut to finding the market prices, and in general has no validity on its own. Now, this has several important implications. The first is it doesn't really matter whether the model is right or not, as long as it reproduces prices in conjunction with the calibration we happen to be using. When people use the Black-Scholes model, it is because it's convenient and has roughly the right shape, not because anyone believes it is exactly right. I'll come back to why this is important in a minute. The second point is that, where possible, we should of course be using implied parameters, not historic ones. The implied parameters are just those things that, in conjunction with the model used, get back to the market prices. When a market participant quotes an implied volatility, it's just short-term for the price. They are famously the wrong numbers in the wrong formula that give you the right answer. The fact that market volatilities are typically higher than historic volatilities just indicate the Black-Scholes model is only an approximation, and it misses some things out. The only real test of the calibration is, therefore, how well it reproduces market prices. I would take issue with the point the authors make, that this makes it possible to have two market-consistent models that give different answers. I would argue that in such a case, at least one of the models is incorrect, or more likely, it's ill-calibrated. Getting an appropriate calibration data set is where the art of modelling takes over, and the science tends to fall behind. I do look forward to the day when we see some research into how to hedge long-term liabilities using the shorter-dated, more liquid options available to remove some of the subjectivity around our illiquid markets. Now, this brings me to the issue of credit risk, on which the paper spends some time. Given what I have just said, the real question and the real issue should not be what is the risk-free rate. Instead, we need to ask, what credit risk is there in the potential hedging assets out there? If the assets themselves are credit risk-free, the calibration parameters, including the risk-free rate, is irrelevant. When it comes to modelling assets underlying the asset share, I don't think the question of a risk-free rate matters one jot. Any credit risk is just part of the return on these assets, which are in any event valued at face value. When it comes to value and guarantees, the appropriate hedging instruments and derivative securities. And I think it's widely accepted that nowadays these are generally credit risk free. They weren't in the past, but nowadays I think they are. Derivative exchanges, etc., exist primarily to remove counterparty credit risk. There will always be a small amount of risk, but it's only a few basis points. I think the implication of this is that no adjustment should be made when calibrating to the market prices of derivatives for credit risk, unlike the approach adopted in the paper. The only area in which I think there is a real issue is when we're looking at fixed liabilities, including GAR costs. Here the issue is there are a number of possible hedging assets, all of which seem as if they'd be a good match, but they have widely different prices and yields. And the question is, which one do we pick and why are they different? What should we do? One approach that the authors like. One approach which the authors like is to try and pick a true risk-free rate. I think this is an excellent idea when you're doing market-consistent EVs and you want to know how does the market think. I don't agree with it when you're trying to do a solvency calculation when you're saying, could I afford to buy a hedge? There's no point knowing the cost of an asset that doesn't exist.
Cameron Ferrucci. And then Ivor Kenner.
Cameron Ferrucci. I would like to thank the authors for their considerable efforts in producing this very useful paper. There are two areas I wish to comment on. First, market-consistent shareholder valuation discussed in Section 7 of the paper. The authors look to a day where the accounting basis is genuinely market consistent on both the asset and liability side, and so there would be no need to separately value the runoff of in-force prudential margins. However, we appear to be a long way off achieving a consensus over a market consistent accounting basis. The recent November 2003 IASB board minutes indicated that they would revisit their tentative insurance phase 2 conclusions from first principles, with no decisions reached until June 2005 at the earliest. This is just as well, because some of their tentative conclusions, such as the use of entry fair value and the inclusion of market value margins, do not accord with the type of prospective valuations put forward by the authors. Also, it wouldn't surprise me if, by mid-2005, any proposed accounting basis was still not truly market consistent. And so, for practical reasons, I believe shareholder valuations will continue to start with a prudential balance sheet, whether statutory or accounting, and examine the runoff of prudential margins. I believe analysts will continue to demand the publication of last year's value of new business to enable them to proxy a value of future new business. Any other calculation may be too subjective for their liking. We are then back to having both a value of in-force and value of new business calculation, hopefully determined using market-consistent principles. Such methodology is already reasonably well developed and has been implemented by several UK insurers. Second, in section 2.4.7 of the paper, the authors complain about the lack of convergence for reported valuations for life business as compared with the banking world. In these early days, I would argue that any lack of consensus around the exact market consistent method or value is not as material as the divergence that used to exist before market consistent valuation was widespread. Until recently, valuation actuaries were faced with the choice of subjective deterministic methods, including stress tests, or quantile reserving stochastic methods based on subjective statistical asset models to try and estimate the cost of embedded options and guarantees. None of these valuation methods gave objective or convergent results. In this context, convergence in results of different valuations of the same business is one of the triumphs of the market-consistent method. Last year, the With-Profits Working Party compared option valuation results using 6 market-consistent stochastic asset models. I suspect that if this exercise were to be repeated today, variations of the results of most models would be of the order of 5% or less, a historic low for the valuation of business with embedded options and guarantees. In addition, I would naturally expect less convergence in the valuation of insurance products than the standard banking products. The insurance market is less efficient. I suspect that if you were to look at some of the longer-term exotic options and structured products being offered by banks, you would also find such divergence in the price. Of course, convergence is desirable. 5% of a liability is a large number and may mean the difference between being insolvent and solvent. So I appreciate the need to try and narrow this down. However, we should not underestimate where we have got to already. Thank you.
Ivor Kenner and then Mike Kipling.
Ivor Kenner. I welcome the general acceptance referred to in paragraph 2.2, page 4, that share prices are affected by the supply and demand for shares. It was not always so, it wasn't always accepted. This merits further consideration. For at least 30 years, much more cash has been coming into the long-term financial institutions in the form of premiums, contributions, etc., than has been paid out in the form of sums assured pensions, etc. In practice, outgoings have been paid out of incomings without the need to test the market by selling shares. This has saved dealing costs. It has meant that terminal bonuses and other forms of capital appreciation are purely theoretical amounts. The new policyholder's premium pays for the old policyholder's terminal bonus. There is also the problem of how to invest the excess of incoming over outgoing money. Briefly, this has meant that supply and demand for shares, which we have now all agreed on, I'm glad to see, has, in practice, been a continuous demand for shares. With only 3 serious blips, Share prices went up and up until the 31st of December 1999, when the FTSE 100 reached 6990.2, and shares were obviously overpriced in comparison with stagnant distributable profits. This situation of, quote, too much money chasing too few shares explains why, as in paragraph 7.1, pages 49 to 50, market capitalization exceeds accounting net assets for all healthy quoted firms, whether financial or otherwise. When one considers the near exponential explosion of share prices which took place up till the 31st of December 1999, the excess is still substantial, though not as large as at 31st of December 1999. This excess is not worth anything until it is realised by the actual selling of shares. Anyone not selling shares is placing a bet against the future. Thank you.
Mike Kipling and then Steve Mills.
Mike Kipling. I'm speaking tonight as the chairman of the Life Board Supervision Committee. The committee is at present engaged on a thorough revision of professional guidance to coincide with the introduction of the FSA's Integrated Prudential Sourcebook towards the end of 2004. As was announced at the Birmingham Life Convention in November 2003, the guidance will take one of two types. The first will be guidance addressed to actuaries appointed to particular roles under the new regime, actuarial function holder, with profits actuary, etc. And they will mainly cover the obligations of the particular roles. The second type will be technical guidance, which will set minimum standards for particular tasks, irrespective of the actuary or other person carrying them out. We are at present preparing four technical guidance notes covering mathematical reserves, with profits insurance capital components, capital assessments, ICAs, and the use of stochastic models. The note on stochastic models will be particularly relevant to the other three, but particularly to those on with profits insurance capital components and on carrying out capital assessments. The guidance will be applicable directly to actuaries carrying out these activities under specific FSA rules. However, they will also count as generally accepted actuarial practice and so be required to be taken into account by firms where the FSA rules place obligations on firms rather than directly on specified actuaries. We intend to expose informally our work in progress at the current issues seminar in April, and for the notes to be finalised and put through as much due process as possible as soon as FSA make final rules. In the meantime, we hope the members will begin to take into account in their work the direction being taken, as can be observed at the April presentations. Of particular relevance tonight is the guidance on stochastic modelling. This has been developed by a working group which includes members from FSA, from regulated firms, from potential reviewing actuaries, and from more than one economic model provider. It is taking forward the work of Carl Douthwaite's 2003 working party on stochastic modelling, and both Carl and one of tonight's authors, Andrew Smith, are members. Amongst the issues which we are currently investigating are explanations of the spread between the gilt yield curve and swaps and other government-backed sterling fixed interest securities, the stochastic modelling of annuitant mortality improvement, stochastic property models, referring to the recent paper by Booth and others and to the implied high costs of property option trading, which we've heard about already tonight, the possibility of setting minimum standards relating to fat-tailed calibration of UK equities, and extrapolation of parameters, especially volatility, to durations where markets are illiquid. The guidance will embrace both models for market-consistent valuations and real-world models for ICAs, and will highlight the differences. We will be taking into account all comments made tonight and look forward to an interesting ongoing debate at SILA and over the summer. Thank you.
and then Ian Moran.
Steve Mills. First of all, I'd like to echo what everybody else has said about how this was such an interesting paper. It raised lots of issues throughout the paper, a lot of which are deserving of a lot more conversation than we've got time for tonight. I'm going to just restrict myself to three areas. The first of those is the gilts versus swaps debate again. My position on this is alongside Colin and diametrically opposite the authors in that I believe in the use of a yield curve that reproduces LIBOR and swap rates. This is the yield curve that underpins all of the derivative markets, and it's unique. Unlike gilt yield curves, where the gilt yield curve actually depends on which gilts you choose to calibrate to, which I always find sort of quite difficult to get to terms with. And to just attempt to value options using gilt yield curves just feels like fitting a square peg into a round hole. If you're a derivative trader sitting there pricing an option, you'll have a Black-Scholes formula into which you can plug an interest rate and a volatility taken from your current market volatility matrix. If we're going to use a different interest rate in the formula, then we can either replicate the market volatilities or the market option prices, but there's no way that we can replicate both. And I'm wondering if people have thought about which one of those two is actually more important to replicate if we are going to go with gilts. There's been letters from the FSA talking about the possibility of actually using interest rates derived from swaps, but maybe with a bit of a reduction for the credit risk. I'm wondering whether the problem is that we're not clear which market we're actually trying to be consistent with. If we're trying to be consistent with the actual market for derivatives, then there's no need to put that credit adjustment in there. Or maybe the problem is that we actually keep calling it a risk-free interest rate. Why don't we start calling it the interest rate at which it's appropriate to discount fixed cash flows? Second point is one that's sort of increasing concern to auditors looking at realistic balance sheets, and that's whether market consistent valuation really is objective. The authors in section 2.4 point out that this is one of the big motivations for market consistent valuation, and it's also one of the reasons that I kind of believe in market consistent valuation as well. But it would be a mistake to think that they are totally objective, because as people keep saying, the derivative market isn't complete enough to actually give us all of the parameters that we need within our models to sort of be market consistent. I'm thinking about things like equity volatility at long durations, property volatility, correlations between returns on different asset classes. If there aren't derivatives out there in the market whose prices depend on these things, there's no way that you can actually find parameters out in the market. So I think the question that the calibrator needs to ask himself is, what would be the price of a derivative that did depend on this parameter if there was a derivative like there out there in the market? But one of the things that the paper points out is that that's actually pretty difficult. If you just think about property, your first thought about property might be to just say, well, we can use a similar model to equities, but maybe with a lower volatility because we expect property prices to actually not be as volatile. But as the authors point out in paragraph 7.3.5, in actual fact, if there were property derivatives out there in the market, the difficulties in hedging them by buying and selling tiny little chunks of factories backwards and forwards means that volatilities would actually go through the roof. So, you know, that is going to be tricky. And I think maybe there's a need for a central body to kind of rule on these things and give central guidance on all of the subjective areas within a market-consistent valuation, because that's the only way that you're going to be able to get values that analysts can look at and that know are consistent between life offices. I'm going to go now. If I did have a third point to make, it was going to be about closed-form solutions, which I'll probably end up talking about afterwards.
We look forward to reading that in the BOJ, Steve.
Yes, it'll be in there. Cheers.
Ian Moran, and then Peter Needleman, please.
Hello, Ian Moran. I thoroughly enjoyed this paper by Andrew and Tim. While at times the reputation of our profession seems to members to be under a cloud or influence, our influence less than it was in the past, and fearful of what Penrose may assert, the profession can be justifiably proud that it encourages and promotes the publication of such an excellent paper and its debate. In particular, this paper is one of many examples and of influential papers in the area of financial theory from Andrew, which has helped to keep both individuals and the profession at the forefront of issues relevant to regulators and accounting setters. This is Andrew's strength, rather than passing the actual exams, and in my view, it is time for us to make an honourable fellow of him. I should disclose my interest. I do actually work alongside Andrew. I wish to focus my comments primarily on actuarial standards, of which I'm a member of the Actuarial Professions Working Party. This is a very topical paper at the moment, and it's currently discussing recommendations on this topic. Now, in paragraph 2.5.5, the paper discusses the commercial implications where there is leeway, i.e. fudge factor or whatever other adjective you wish to use, on liability valuations. In particular, the consequence of identifying best practices when maybe lesser practices may lead to lower valuations. Competition in laxity is a phrase probably Andrew inserted in the paper. In my experience, this is a real issue rather than a theoretical issue, but it is to the credit of the profession that it is less prevalent than it might otherwise be, and it also highlights the conflict between the commercial and professional roles and the need for any standards to be demonstrably independent. Moving on to paragraph 4.3.5 and 4.3.7, this informs us about issues over data, and there have been many speakers today highlighting the issues and the difficulties of this area. He uses the example of equity volatility, quoting, long-term data is merely extrapolated from actual short-term data. If the investment bankers who you've rung up to get your price know that you're not going to buy or sell at that price, they'll do whatever the easiest and they'll take a shortcut and simply extrapolate. This highlights the need for professional scepticism in selecting and relying on market data and professional judgment in estimating key assumptions in the absence of reliable data and appropriate training or access for the actuary to have to experts in this area. I would say that I think this area was the one thing that struck me most clearly from the paper, and that is the need for really some very good guidance over the use of market data, sampling and use of that. Section 2 discusses the appropriateness of market consistency as a measurement objective. Whilst I personally accept the merits of arguments for market consistent value for reporting, I do believe that the profession should encourage further debate. And just to close, if I may, very briefly, the production of guidance for individual actuaries has not kept pace with the rapid development of realistic balance sheets. We are exposed to the regulator changing the requirements and backfilling the gaps in technical developments. And I think that Andrew's and Tim's paper provides us an excellent and robust information about many of the technical aspects, and I thank the authors.
Peter Needleman and then David Smith.
I'd like to thank the authors for this paper, which reinforces many of the points made in the papers presented and discussed at the Institute last November on the calculation of realistic liabilities. Tonight's paper again highlights that there is a wide range of views and significant scope for judgment in many of the areas relevant to the valuation of liabilities on a market-consistent basis. I'd like to comment on three areas relevant to this evening's paper. Firstly, the complexity of calculations and dynamic interactions. The move to realistic reporting, and in particular recognising the true value of the options and guarantees inherent in with-profit contracts, is an enormous and important step forward for the industry and regulators. Companies now need time to bed down their systems and their controls, and whether they are using closed-form solutions or Monte Carlo simulations, they need to ensure the robustness of what they've developed. One of the issues the paper focuses on is the use of closed-form solutions to value many of the options and guarantees embedded in with-profit contracts, and the paper advocates the merits of this approach rather than the use of Monte Carlo simulations. It demonstrates how formulae can be developed to allow, to some extent, for dynamic management actions and other complexities. But the authors themselves recognise the limitations of closed-form solutions. In particular, they note in 8.22 that they cannot be used when the investment mix depends on the free asset ratio. Now, in practice, that is the situation which applies to most companies. I believe firmly in the 80-20 rule. You get 80% of the benefit from 20% of the effort, and I suggest the same applies here, and would caution against trying to achieve a level of theoretical correctness that ignores the practical realities. I also support the approach suggested by Professor Wilkie in the discussion at the November meeting, in that a relatively simple approach should be used to establish the liabilities, and the more sophisticated stochastic modelling using real-world scenarios should be focusing on determining the total capital requirements and helping to understand the risks that can be managed in practice. This brings me on to the second point regarding asset strategy and hedging. One of the main risks in with-profit funds is the mismatch risk arising from having a heavily equity-backed investment strategy whilst providing onerous guarantees. As companies become more capital constrained, they're having to become much more sophisticated in their approach to hedging these guarantees. As Section 9 of the paper quite rightly points out, this will mean moving away from crediting uniform investment returns to all policies. Some companies are already following different investment strategies for assets backing guarantee reserves, and in a few cases are differentiating the equity mix for major groups of contracts. In some cases, this is based on business written before or after a specific date, for example, the date of demutualisation, and in other cases, for different classes of policies. I'm aware of at least one company which is considering a more sophisticated approach to differentiating asset mix by duration and/or the extent to which guarantees are in the money. A key concern here is whether a differentiated policy is consistent with treating policyholders fairly, and I know the FSA have expressed some concerns. The answers will depend on the precise circumstances and approach, but I believe that we will see and should allow a much greater degree of differentiation in the future.
Peter, lastly, can you precede your last point?
Lastly, please let me comment on the need for guidance and greater consistency of approach. The industry and profession are moving forward rapidly with the implementation of market-consistent valuations, and as with other areas of actuarial and financial theory, there's significant scope for judgment and differences in opinions. The paper highlights some of the more contentious areas, but unfortunately is diminished by the author's apparent assumption that anyone holding differing views to their own must have questionable motives. Such innuendo is quite unhelpful if we are to stimulate appropriate professional debate. The profession has established a working party to provide guidance around stochastic models, and I'm sure that those serving on it will frame guidance with appropriate professional impartiality. I hope this can be framed in a way which... Last line. I hope this can be framed in a way which provides a level playing field, but still allows scope for judgment. And on the question of level playing field, let's also make sure that the UK reserving and capital requirements are not so far ahead of our other European insurance markets that we have no industry left to regulate. Thank you.
And then Ed Stumpf.
David Smith. Thanks again to the authors for an interesting paper. I can't claim to have understood all the theory, but at least I now know two people who can help. I just hope their fee basis is simpler than their formula. My comments tonight relate to the more practical aspects of stochastic modelling and are in respect of an office that has had stochastic model on part of its with profits business for almost 15 years. In recent years, a new stochastic model has been built using a modern platform, and this now covers 95% of with-profits business. Using 25 PCs linked together, a stochastic run of 1,000 scenarios runs overnight. With 75 dedicated PCs, 3 runs can be achieved each night. With that hardware, some simplifications have been necessary. A slimmed-down model point set with just 10,000 cells representing the in-force business means that some of the accuracy of more detailed deterministic models has been discarded. Also, the control projection and review of bonus rates up to 20 years ahead has been replaced by codified rules applied automatically even in extreme situations. In the context of a fair value of liabilities, this approach may be acceptable, as mean values will depend on the middle-of-the-pack scenarios
more than on the tails. However, while this realistic fair value is a relevant measure, unless the liabilities are hedged, then it is only part of the picture. A fuller picture comes from a risk-based capital assessment, but in this case it is the extreme conditions that will determine the capital required. As such, a formulaic bonus approach could produce very different results to those that would follow detailed consideration if such conditions actually occurred. At a more fundamental level, there is a question whether the aim of a market-consistent valuation is a sufficient principle on its own. Investment markets value financial instruments of uncertain value, such as equities, efficiently in that a relatively deep and liquid market exists. However, the derived values undergo significant realignments from time to time in a manner that would not be desirable in the context of the prudential supervision of insurance companies. This might be taken to indicate that there should be a further principle of financial soundness, so that the implied assumptions, including future returns and volatilities, represent a reasonable, sound and stable set of assumptions for the future. Summing all this up, whilst having a realistic valuation of life insurance liabilities as the basis of published financial accounts is a commendable aim, the subject is only newly developed and will need to evolve. In the meantime, liability values and capital requirements placed on our businesses can be expected to fluctuate due to modelling issues and due to methods applied for exercise of management discretion, as well as due to market conditions. This leads to a view that reporting of realistic balance sheets should, at this stage, remain confidential. Thank you.
And then Neil Tavernan.
Good evening, my name is Ed Stumpf. I'd like to make some brief comments to address the discussion in section 8 of the paper. This discusses the relative merits of Monte Carlo modelling versus closed form alternatives. Specifically, I'd like to make the case for closed form solutions not as an alternative to Monte Carlo methods, but as a complement to such methods. I think the paper provides extensive applications for closed form solutions in the calculation of market consistent valuation of insurance liabilities. These methods are potentially ideal for the calculation of a realistic balance sheet in many scenarios. However, they do not imply that the closed form solution should be viewed purely as an alternative to stochastic methods. Stochastic modelling is a very powerful tool for managing an insurance concern. It is easy to understand and it enables managers to study not just values but distributions of values. The combination of a closed form solution such as those provided in this paper with Monte Carlo modelling provides an even better tool for managing an insurance fund. I've seen this in practice for the projection of a company's realistic balance sheet under stochastic conditions. A stochastic model is used to project and generate future scenarios and revenue accounts and balance sheet liabilities. A graphical presentation of these liabilities can then look at such things as free asset ratio percentiles over time under realistic conditions. I'm convinced that the use of both Monte Carlo and closed form solutions together has valuable implications for understanding solvency in the future and for the calculation of capital requirements such as ICA. Thank you.
Neil Tavernor. I'd like to make some comments on the paper from the point of view of someone actively involved in the corporate valuation of life insurers in an M&A context. I do congratulate the authors on a stimulating and lucid discussion of many of the more theoretical aspects of valuing insurance cash flows, and these ideas can clearly be developed reasonably straightforwardly, although admittedly not by me, into closed-form solutions for valuing individual contracts or homogeneous portfolios, provided there are relatively few non-economic assumptions which have correlation with the markets. This may not be the case in practice, particularly if we are looking at a corporate valuation, where, for example, market-correlated policyholder behaviour, such as lapse, surrender and propensity to buy, could clearly affect the value via future unit costs, for example. I was disappointed that, despite the title of the paper, the authors did not devote much time to valuing insurance businesses as a whole. In Section 7, they set out a summary of the valuation framework of net assets plus franchise value less frictional costs. Without further developing the theory, as set out, for example, in the paper referred to in 7.2.5, towards a practical approach for corporate valuation. This may perhaps be due to the difficulties of using closed-form solutions for such a purpose, problems which may also underlie some current attempts to estimate market-consistent valuations by simplifying frictional capital costs down to just taxation and a subjective assumption for agency costs, and by assuming that key non-economic parameters are entirely non-systematic and can be treated deterministically. The frictional costs of supporting capital at a sufficient level to support franchise value and or for regulatory or internal purposes will be higher for a company which is exposed to higher volatility in its results, whether this volatility is market correlated or not. Companies with potentially volatile results should be holding more capital in the first place, and so valuations which do not look at capital requirements and how they evolve in future may potentially under or overstate the frictional costs. Companies which can demonstrate a clear understanding of required capital, capital strategy and capital costs may be able to argue that any residual agency costs assumed should be lower than if they cannot. It may be possible to derive better approximate methods for allowing for frictional costs, and these may be used as a short-term solution. However, it seems preferable to me in the medium term to be working towards efficient stochastic simulation models for capital adequacy that can also be used for market-consistent corporate valuations. As suggested by the authors, it could well be that closed-form solutions for at least some elements of projected balance sheets will be an essential part of such models. As a final comment from an M&A perspective, considerable thought and specialist expertise is necessary to construct closed-form solutions in both the approximations necessary in order to be able to apply them and in the formulae themselves. The authors mention that different actuaries are likely to derive different solutions and values depending on their view of policyholder behaviour, etc. I do have some concerns as to the length of time it would take for a potential buyer of a company in an M&A context to satisfy itself of the appropriateness of a closed-form model, and if necessary, to adapt it to reflect any different views it might have of policyholder and management behaviour, particularly as the impact of the results as part of a larger group could be quite different from that on a standalone basis. Stochastic simulation techniques, while perhaps more time-consuming to run, seem to me to be far more amenable to independent verification and perhaps more importantly, to understanding.
That's the 13. Could I ask now a show of hands of those who'd like to make a further contribution? One. We need more. Two.
Three, four.
Okay. David?
David Wilkie. I seem to come in the right alphabetical order anyway. It's very useful that Peter Needleman has already given me a trailer, as it were, by agreeing with what I said last time, some of which I'll repeat this time. I do think this is a very useful paper, but in my view it is only part of the story, because, as Peter outlined, my view is that what you need is a simulation model which represents the real world and is as complicated as you like. And inside that, you simulate the hedging strategy that you're going to use, because an important point that earlier speakers have made comments on opposite sides, the value of an option depends entirely on the fact that you can hedge using the right sort of assets. So the option pricing depends entirely on the assets available to hedge with. You can't say, therefore, that value of a liability is independent of the assets. It's the assets that you could hedge with. And you need to know, therefore, the hedging proportions. And the hedging proportions are not readily available from this paper. Look at the long formula at the top of page 42 in section 5.7.8, actually. Sometimes you can see the hedging proportions automatically. I can't see the hedging proportions from that at all easily, and I strongly suspect that one of the pluses should be a minus somewhere in it. because if you're going to hedge a guaranteed annuity option, you need a positive holding of the deferred annuity and a negative holding of a zero coupon bond somewhere along the line. Yes, but you need the negative bit in it somewhere. The authors can probably elaborate that later. The advantage of the real-world simulation is you can put in all sorts of complications. You can allow for the management activity. You can allow for parameter uncertainty, for stochastic mortality, or uncertainty about mortality. It ends up with providing you with prudent values as well as average values. And then in the fair market value, in my view, is the average plus some allowance for the cost of capital, for the cost of renting the what I would call contingency reserves, the extra that you need for the prudent value. And the authors do recognise this when they're talking in section 643, I think it is, about the difference between implied volatility and historical volatility. The actual option prices are bigger than what one might call the theoretical net option prices because of all these other factors that they have mentioned, in particular the necessity for the option hedgers to have option writers to have additional reserves because you can't hedge perfectly. And if you're then going to embed all this, the hedging strategy, inside a real-world simulation model, you've got to use closed-form solutions. And I'd much rather have a simple closed-form solution and a complicated real-world stochastic model than too elaborate or such an elaborate hedging model or option pricing model that you can only calculate it with simulations inside other simulations. So that's why I say it's only a part of the story, but it does sound from what Mike Kipling was saying that the life board is taking on part of what I was saying already. It might even be taking on all of it, and if so, I hope so. Thank you.
Thank you, David. One at a time. Come on.
I'm Ian Sykes. This isn't going to take very long because I'm a pensions actuary, so I have no profound technical comments apart from saying, like everybody else, thank you for an interesting and short paper. There were some references to the BT pension deficit in the paper, and I thought I'd take a quick opportunity to comment on that. It's really good to be in a meeting where actuaries talk about what the correct discount rate to use is, and they're arguing about the difference between gilt and swaps. I wish that that was the sort of argument that happened within the pension profession. And there is a serious point here. It worries me that there is such a big difference between the two arms of the profession. And particularly it worries me when they meet, for instance, referring to BT, why should there be such a difference between the value put on pension liabilities when they're held by BT and even when they were taken over by an insurance company? It just doesn't make sense to me. The other comment I'd make about the debate is that pension actuaries, lots of us have happily accepted FRS 17 as being a welcome move towards reality, but we must remember that although it's a move in the right direction, the fact is it's still valuing the wrong liabilities using the wrong discount rate, and we shouldn't give in the fight to get correct and transparent accounting. Just on a completely separate note, all of the models cited in this paper rely on lots of information about market prices, particularly of options. Now, I, as an actuary working in a pensions department, would love to have access to that information. Unless I'm missing something, it's not readily available, and yes, you've got a large investment department. And I wonder whether the Institute might consider actually making some of this information, and indeed the subsequent development of yield curves and things, available to the profession as a whole, so that we don't have to go out and pester the poor investment banking profession ourselves individually. Thank you.
Yes, hi. Gary Finkelstein is the name, and congratulations to the authors for a very interesting paper, which I wish I had written myself. Sadly, I didn't.
Starting off in the beginning, section 1.1.2, where they was section 1.1 where they define market consistency. I thought the definition of market consistency was a little weak, and it could have been stronger. And the analysis later on in section 4.2.1. where they speak about they don't call it a necessary and sufficient condition, but a criterion for a market consistent calibration is that the model should seek to replicate market prices of selected assets, including options, in the market. I think that is clearly the important criterion of what market consistency is. And with that definition of what it means to be market consistent, one can then start to take a view of whether other things, like whether you should be calibrating to gilt yields or to swap rates, or what models are the right models to use, can be thought through. Because fundamentally, if traders for assets which replicate the guaranteed cost cash flows, even in the world of no management actions, are being priced using a certain model or a certain yield curve, then if you want to calibrate that market price, well, one should try to use the same sort of model that's used out there. Section 4.3 covered some of the problems with calibrating market-consistent models. In fact, I thought it was quite a lengthy discussion of the problems you might encounter. I wish I'd seen more solutions to the problems, though. One comment I will make is in section 4.3.4, the authors suggest that it's very hard to find even over-the-counter options of greater than 5 years. I'm certainly aware of a growing number of banks who are willing to trade longer than 5 years, even longer than 10. I have to say, though, I share the sentiment of previous speakers. It would be nice if we could have, similar to a continuous mortality investigation bureau where we keep statistics on mortality rates, if we could keep statistics on volatilities. The problem is that they, like mortality, actually, is quite a proprietary variable affecting prices. Tax is a complicating animal. It was discussed briefly in section 3.5.8. I thought the analysis in 3.5.6 was a little spurious, but tax was dealt with, I think, a lot more diligently and extensively in section 4.7. One thing, clearly, it's helpful to always remember the difference between a life fund, where currently we're an XSI or I minus E tax basis, and pensions, where you're taxed on profits, although never forget that there may be a needs test or a floor test biting. So even in a profits assessment, there are dynamics tax scenarios which are hard to put through in a closed-form formula. But sticking to life business, I minus E, it's clear that if you try to delta hedge the embedded option, you will struggle to earn the risk-free rate gross of tax. The authors have made good suggestions. If you did want to make simple deterministic inputs about the tax rate for netting, to be cautious that you don't end up giving yourself credit for tax relief on unrealized losses, which is typically the scenarios when guarantees cost bite, you get unrealized capital losses. But what I would say is that there is an alternative way of thinking about things. If you think of valuing the guarantee cost by replication, and by that I mean determining the put option or set of assets whose cash flows would match the guarantee cost cash flows under all possible scenarios, then if your valuation philosophy is what it would cost you in the market to hedge out the risk from a third party, if your third party can earn the risk-free rate gross of tax, then your third party would use a gross of tax risk-free assumption. However, then you need to think carefully about what tax you would incur on the option payoff to cover your guaranteed cost cash flows, and I should caution you that that's quite a specialised tax bill.
Any more?
Almost there, yeah, sorry.
Good.
on the
30 seconds.
Okay, I'll cut down there. I'll jump to the compound formula in section 5.7.8, which hasn't had a lot of discussion.
except for a challenge at whether there should be a minus sign instead of a plus sign. I would say it would have been helpful if the authors did include a derivation, perhaps in an appendix. But I noticed that they've used the compound option pricing methodology from Gehi. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing the name correctly. What I do know is that Gehi extended their work in a later paper in 1979, and it was extended further by Hodge and Silby in 1987 and Rubinstein in 1991. I suppose I'll put the references in the written transcript.
Thank you, Gary.
And I believe the last of those does indicate hedging strategies. I suppose my final... All right. I'll quit while I'm ahead.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It'll be my luck now. No one else wants to speak, of course. Hang on, you've had a bite. Mike?
Mike Ermston. I'm pleased to say that I'm a somewhat biased company, actually, at this point, and it would be worthwhile supporting the independent nature of the paper. I think particularly in view of the criticism, perhaps, of the medical profession that we've seen in the last few weeks, President, to have papers written by independent people is actually a very good thing for the profession as a whole. Anyway, despite that, I'm going to comment.
Good.
I think one just needs to... I'm very supportive of market consistency, but I think we do need to understand the position of the industry as a whole, and the position not only of with-profit funds and of life insurance companies in the UK, that they do not have an unlimited amount of capital at the current time. And I think that what we have seen over the last few weeks is not necessarily to the advantage of the industry, where we see a major life insurer having to sell very large amounts of UK equities driven by these results. I think what I would say is, although I'm a big supporter of market consistency, we should try to manage the transition quite carefully, and I hope the FSA will try to do that, not just for with-profit funds, but for shareholder funds and for non-profit funds as we move further down this market-consistent road. We haven't discussed the pricing of annuities this evening, but it does seem to me that there are very few companies out there pricing annuities on anything like swap rates or risk-free rates. The third point I would make is around Monte Carlo methods, which actually I'm a big fan of. And I think the issue with Monte Carlo methods is the difficulty of doing all the calculations. But I think if you do those scenarios, you do discover that some of the real tail scenarios are quite remote and very extreme, and maybe ones that you can deal with by quite extreme or by sensible management actions, which are not in your normal management action set. So I do think that that is an argument for the use of Monte Carlo methods. Thank you.
Right. Any more? Who's next? If I don't have another one, I'm going to be forced to ask David Dulloway to speak again. So that's your problem, not mine. Right? Come on, Dave. Okay, I'll get the one upstairs next.
Having been timed out once, I was dying for another go. I'm not going to pick up where I left off. I want to go to one particular point, which is, what are we trying to achieve with a market-consistent valuation? I think sometimes we're trying to achieve two completely different things, and this has an impact on what we do. If we're trying to set a solvency valuation, we're using market consistency as a tool to say, if things go badly wrong, do we have enough money to go and buy some hedging assets and basically get out of the game? If that's our purpose, it tells us a lot of things about calibration, about tax and so on. It tells us calibrate to what's out there. It tells us that if you can't buy it, if you can't actually go and do the trade, it's not worth thinking about. tells us a tax position we're interested in is the one we're going to be in when things go wrong and we have to go out there and do the hedge. If, on the other hand, we're talking about market-consistent valuation as a measure of shareholder value, then we're saying quite a different thing. We're saying, how does the market generally look at these cash flows, given you keep them within the company? It's much more important, what is the real risk-free rate? Because we're asking, again, how do people think about cash flows as a whole, not within a particular hedging circumstance? We need to take account of individual credit risk, and the tax that would apply is the tax when you carry on running as a going concern. Now, I think an awful lot of the problems we have in disagreements between risk-free rates, tax approaches and so on is simply that we're not clear, and to be fair, the FSA is not always clear, about what it is we're trying to do when we do something market consistent. If we can agree on that, I think we'll find that the differences between people with different views are far smaller and the range of results we get is far narrower than we're seeing at the moment. And you didn't even have to push the red button.
Somebody wants to make a contribution from the gallery? Yes? Would you like to come to the front? Is there a microphone up there? No. Could you come to the front and shout? Could you shout even louder than that, please?
Shout even louder?
Even louder.
Right.
Thank you.
I just had a few comments to make. She can now probably hear.
No.
Like the mention actually spoke briefly, I'm extremely pleased to hear a debate between closed-form solutions and successful models, as opposed to deterministic methods. This is a truly excellent result. On some of the technicalities, the debate about long-term equity volatility, we recognise as a problem. Interestingly, of course, the insurance companies who granted those long-term equity options for policyholders, so of course, one would have all thought about what the correct volatility was in pricing. Swaps versus gilts. As a regulator, we've just been spending a lot of time worrying about reinsurance and the credit risk within that, for general insurance in particular, but also life. I was glad to hear from the swap supporters that you can have complete assurance or reassurance from a bank, even if you can't be reassured. And more generally, hedging and the reference to real world models and hedging there, that struck me as two dangers there, that if you're in a real world model, I have difficulty seeing how hedging works when you know roughly which way the model is headed. But I think hedging more generally must be to be commended. Hedging to date seems to us has always been about the statutory valuation basis and not actually against the real guarantees within the portfolio. There is therefore a danger that today's hedging plans do about today's worries. Equity markets go down. Our worry, if that could be a worry, is equity markets go up and the hedging strategy is going short in equities, therefore go the wrong way to the office. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any more? Do we give a bit of silence to... No? All done? Okay. I shall now ask Seamus Creedon to close the discussion.
Thank you, President. Seamus Creedon. Tonight's paper and the discussion are important not only in the context of the FSA's aspiration to implement a modern regime of balance sheet supervision here in the United Kingdom, but also in the context of similar moves at the European level, which will shortly move into high gear. And our thanks are due to the authors and to all who contributed to the discussion. The import of this subject also is not confined to life assurance. Although less significant, there are some direct parallels in relation to general insurance. And I can share with Ian Sykes envisaging a growing interest in market-consistent assessment of the position of pension schemes. I agree very much with the authors and with those who contributed to the discussion along the lines that perfect market consistency is an unattainable aspiration. I also agree that the realistic objective is to eliminate, so far as we can, the market inconsistencies which have survived in some dark corners. Certainly the techniques proposed by the authors should inform the future pricing of liability origination and the management of existing liability portfolios. It is very unfair to the authors to share David Wilkie's wish that they had written a different and broader paper. But I do find it hard in my own mind to separate the aspiration for market consistency from the broader objective of assessment of the adequacy of total assets to meet liabilities in adverse circumstances. In fairness to the authors, I have worked alongside both of them last year and this in investigating some of the issues in capital and asset adequacy assessment, so perhaps they may come back again. An advantage of considering valuation in its context of asset adequacy assessment is that different judgments made in valuation should, all other things being equal, be balanced by opposite differences in the margins required to meet a given level of stress. Provided the supervisor is aware of its actions, an element of arbitrariness or simplicity in determining valuation principles is not the end of the world. And I note that the latest European Union paper on Solvency II considers this point briefly. Indeed, the FSA and the UK actuarial profession have moved slightly out of step with counterparts in other jurisdictions in the current heavy emphasis on realistic liability valuation, when it is really asset adequacy which should be the primary concern of us all. I suspect this is just a temporary difference of emphasis, reflecting some of the unique characteristics of UK with-profits business. In a recent presentation with Dutch colleagues to supervisors in Bonn of the contrasting UK and Dutch approaches, we all reached the conclusion simultaneously that combining the UK and the Dutch approaches could actually create something sensible. Dealing with some of the specific themes of the discussion, in section two, the authors discussed the motivations for market consistency, and a point echoed by several others. I think it is important to raise these, if only to push the FSA to think harder about its own motivation and requirements. In practice, I believe the objectives of understanding share price and closing out risks are somewhat aspirational. And the best to be hoped for is a set of principles and processes which assure auditable objectivity on a basis which is not market inconsistent. A couple of speakers valuably exposed the pitfalls in market consistent valuation for M&A purposes and the need for careful exercise of judgment in that area. Second theme I picked out was supervisory policy, on which the authors had considerable fears. I part company with them a little bit in relation to section 2.5. I'm less pessimistic about either our profession or our supervisors. I believe the supervisory approach is quite ingeniously designed and creates an incentive for firms to reduce likely individual capital guidance by building up a track record of credible individual capital assessment. And this is exactly as it should be. The supervisor seeks an adult relationship with the supervised. Model control was a topic touched on by a couple of speakers. I do remember one of the authors saying to me, I think he spoke in jest a couple of years ago, a main constraint on the sophistication of market consistent, those days we called it fair value, a main constraint on the sophistication of techniques will be the capacity of our colleague audit partners to understand them. There is a serious point about the context in which these techniques are to be used. For example, the modelling of liabilities potentially needs to be much more granular, or granular in a different way from traditions. And our US and Canadian colleagues have already established that issues of model design and model validation are not at all trivial. David Smith touched on some of the physical aspects of building a useful model. I think the good auditor will also be keen to understand any differences between the approach to liability valuation and the way in which management approaches pricing and other management decisions. And making that link will limit the subjectivity which the authors understandably feared. The distinction between efficient and liquid markets and other markets was a theme throughout the discussion this evening, one which the authors acknowledged and for which they gained, I think, almost universal support. There are no easy answers here. A point worth making is that the market for insurance business itself has the potential to become more efficient. There are signs that customers, although behaving irrationally, are acquiring an increasing rationality in their behaviours. The subject of management and customer behaviours generally was not greatly discussed. Some took the view that it was more significant than the authors had allowed, and that allowing properly for management and customer behaviour needs to be able to use Monte Carlo simulation approaches. The author's approach to the difficulties of taxation was supported by Gary Finkelstein. The general issue of formula and Monte Carlo approaches, I think I sensed widespread support for the view that both have their place and indeed deserve to be used in parallel. Closed form solutions can offer greater understanding in certain contexts. Simulation is the sledgehammer which can address dynamic behavioural dimensions and so on. Standards and guidance were a theme of the discussion, and I'm pleased to echo those who said that this is an issue of which the profession is very aware and understands the need for standards which command wide support, not only among actuaries but among firms, and indeed command public confidence. It's not a simple challenge, and the leadership of the profession is well aware of organisational issues and indeed issues about what standards should look like in terms of the balance between principles and rules going forward in the future. A useful point was made, which I think deserves to be taken forward, in terms of sharing some of the effort of data or information development and gathering in relation to the subject of tonight's discussion. I left to last gilts versus swaps. This is potentially a quite significant issue, as the history shows that swap spreads have at times, usually outside the UK, been very material. And there is a great deal of, unfortunately, inconclusive academic research on the reasons for swap spreads. The discussion this evening, I scored about 50-50. For myself, I think I can only go back to the point that I'm not sure there's a perfect right answer here, but in any event, it should be offset in the degree to which assumptions are stress-tested. Those are the main points I took out of the discussion. Thank you.
I'll ask Andrew Smith to respond.
Thank you. I'd like to thank all of you, the speakers, for your kind comments and indeed all of your comments. Most of you actually have reinforced our conviction that market-consistent valuations are a commercially useful tool rather than just a dry compliance exercise. As Seamus has said, a perfect market-consistent valuation is an unrealistic aspiration, And as Colin said, it's a major exercise to compute an answer to an auditable standard within agreed budget and timescale, avoiding results which spook shareholders, policyholders, or analysts. Several people have raised questions about hedging and hedging errors, the need to figure out hedge ratios to allocate capital and the need to charge for it. I can answer straight away David Wilkes' question about the hedge ratios with that rather complicated formula, which is that it's actually analogous to the Black-Scholes formula. If you just each of the cumulative normal terms is the hedge ratio for one of four possible hedging ingredients. So perhaps it's one of those algebraic things that gets horribly messy, and then at the last line, most of the messy terms cancel out. And David also talked about the need to calculate hedge errors under a real-world model, and we agree with that, actually. For product pricing purposes, you would want to figure out how much capital you need and what the cost of that capital is. Just as importantly, if you're calibrating your asset model to market option prices, you would want to recognise that the market implied volatility, some of that corresponds to somebody else's cost of capital. So to avoid double counting, you'd need to strip that bit of somebody else's cost of capital out before you calibrated your model and added in your own cost of capital. It's not easy to do. More work on the details is needed, but it'll be jolly handy when somebody figures them out. It would be unfortunate if professional standards drawn up now unwittingly exclude that kind of model from being used in future for market-consistent valuation. Several speakers have talked about the use of the right discount rates. One of the ways I think about this is to suppose that one of you holds a corporate bond, and I have tried to replicate that corporate bond by holding a deposit which earns LIBOR with a bank, and then I hold a swap to turn that LIBOR into a fixed rate, the same term as your corporate bonds. And we actually have a lot in common. We're both earning more than the rate on gilts. We might actually be earning the same rate. And we're both subject to credit risk. At the moment, under CP195, you would have to do a stress test for credit risk, and I would not, which most people would probably agree was an anomaly. So consensus is growing, and I was reassured to hear tonight nobody is actually claiming that swap rates represent a rate that is free of default risk. Instead, the argument has moved on to whether some credit for default risk should be allowed in regulatory liability valuations. And I think that's an indication of how far we've come, although it seems a little odd that one should look at the credit risk of some bank that you might have no dealings with and implicit in the swap rate rather than, for example, in your own credit risk. And it also seems odd that nobody is arguing the same deduction for credit risk in relation to unit-linked policies. Why should it only apply to with-profit policies? Fortunately, the Life Stochastic Modelling Guidance Group is looking at all that in more detail, so I'm not going to say any more about it now. Oh, yes, I will. I'll say one more thing. In relation to Steve Mills' point, that you can't suggestion that it was difficult to use gilt rates to calibrate a model and then replicate option prices. It's not actually that hard. We show how in 4.3.9. The trick is to realise that the option is subject to credit risk and needs to be valued as such. If you pretend that a bought option, a long-dated option, is free of credit risk, then obviously you won't get back to a market price which does reflect the credit risk. Steve Mills mentioned the valuation of liabilities is an incomplete markets problem. That's right. In the absence of imperfect hedges, there is no unique valuation, which I think explains how you could potentially have two models both claiming to be market consistent and giving different answers. Colin Wilson talked about implied correlations. I suspect when he looks at market prices, the ones I've seen, your implied correlation, the bid-offer bound, is between about minus one and plus one. So not fantastically useful as a way of calibrating models. Also, let us remember that these difficulties in calibrating models, in many cases, the answer is much simpler than is required by a complex model. For example, it's very straightforward to value guaranteed minimum benefits using risk-free rates, and these can actually constitute a large part of a realistic balance sheet. So the difficulty of valuing a five-year guarantee is not an argument for not doing fixed cash flows sensibly. And furthermore, the lack of a unique valuation only applies if you restrict consideration to arguments based on exact hedges. There's all sorts of equilibrium arguments and partial equilibrium approaches, such as those by Cochrane and Iasalia, which give some good and robust ways of coming up with numbers, even in the absence of exact hedges. Colin Wilson suggested that one should look at market implied volatilities for short-term guarantees and then try to blend into something more historically based for the longer term. But in 6.4.3, we give a list of a rather large number of reasons for the difference between historic and implied volatilities. And I think one would have to be fairly clear about at which point of each of those large number of cases you brought in each of those effects if you really wanted to have a curve that blended from historic to implied at different terms. I think that would actually be much more difficult than has been suggested. I'm encouraged by the level of support for an actuarial standards board and for its role in providing consistency for financial reporting and market-based valuations. I fear, however, that some have imagined this board as an administrative function collating implied volatilities from a range of banks. And we've argued that much more than this is required, especially in over-the-counter markets where trades are infrequent and the terms are confidential. Both Ian Moran and Gary Finkelstein highlighted what I call Ryanair prices, where you appear to have a very low option until your credit card numbers are typed in and suddenly the price quadruples. Whatever body sets long-term at-the-money UK equity volatility assumptions will need suitable terms of reference and enough independence to make sound and transparent judgments which will inevitably carry significant commercial consequences. A few speakers noted the limitations of closed-form option pricing formulas, particularly when offices set bonus rates using dynamic fund level decisions, or when dynamic guarantee costs are charged to asset shares, where credit risky assets or illiquid assets are used. And we acknowledge these points in section 8.1.4. Let's not forget, however, that these complicated rules for bonus rates that we're trying to model, until recently, most of them weren't written down at all. And their subsequent codification was often with the specific aim of building Monte Carlo models. So we shouldn't be surprised that it's easier to copy-paste those rules into Monte Carlo models rather than closed-form solutions. But if you had a second chance, which many offices now do as they rewrite their PPFM, why not make life easy for yourself with management practices which are relatively straightforward to model? Mark Chaplin suggested that closed-form solutions would necessarily give higher answers than Monte Carlo models. I have to say that's not our experience. In fact, we'd usually use a Monte Carlo model to calibrate the closed-form solutions. So as a matter of calibration, you would hope they would tie up pretty closely. Finally, I'd like to thank all the speakers for all of your contributions, for your observations and for your suggested ways forward. I know there's some technical points that I haven't responded to now and will respond to those in writing. And valuation models have developed at pace over the last year, and there's little sign of this slowing down. We've made an attempt to organise the techniques currently available, but we very much hope our words won't be the last. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I may just add a few words of my own. I'm looking forward to doing this CPD course in financial economics, and for those of you who've been on the website, you'll know I have a book corner there, and you'll find that there's books not only on financial economics but also now on behavioural finance, which I think has a lot of relevance for us too. And there's only one book there. I'm adding three books on risk, which I expect you to read by the time I finish being president. And the other day we had a meeting here on financial economics, and the one thing I took away from that was that certainly valuations are about financial economics and some behavioural finance, but pricing, as was mentioned from the balcony, the theory was that pricing is pure game theory. So there'll be a book on game theory going in the corner as well. But I think if we put it in the CPD course, we better call it negotiation theory, because otherwise I'm sure the press will get the wrong end of the stick. And finally, one thing that's puzzled me is this, that we've been talking about the market consistent valuation here today, and this is going to be used to add a fairly arbitrarily determined, should I say, initial capital assessment to it to get a determination of a cash flow, like the dividend or a capital requirement. Now, my question is, are all the refinements we've been talking about in this paper, in the base, going to be completely reversed when you add the internal capital assessment? So we get a pretty consistent number which actually determines the cash flow, because this basis won't determine the cash flow. It's this plus the internal capital assessment that will determine the dividend or the capital requirement. And then I look at it back the other way and say, how can you actually do a realistic valuation without knowing what the dividend flow or capital requirement is going to be? So that's something I look forward to learning in the course, or not. And finally, on getting life and pensions actuaries together, this is very close to my heart. And one thing I'm talking about, and those of you who are listening might hear it, is that whether in pensions land we should also be calculating a risk-based capital figure so that those finance directors get some idea what allocation of reserves might be required to actually deliver some of the promises in the scheme booklet. But that's something to think about. So it remains for me to express my thanks, and I'm sure the thanks, there goes another bottle. Thanks for all of us, to the author, opener, closer, and those who participate in this evening's discussion. It'll be very helpful for those preparing the transcript of the discussion for the BAJ if you could hand any prepared notes to Maria Lyons or Tamsin Rees at the back of the hall as you leave. The next meeting will take place at 5 p.m. on Monday the 22nd of March, when a discussion on quantifying operational risk in general insurance companies is scheduled to take place. You're now warmly invited to continue the discussion and join us for a glass of wine in the council chamber. It says here, there goes another one. However, with those attending Gallio and other dining clubs, make sure they leave on time. Now, we have a bit of logistics. For those in the council chamber, you are sitting on a chair. When you stand up, could you grab the chair and move it to the wall, please, so that we have some room for the drinks. Thank you very much indeed.